now for this talk, Rusty Johnson, who needs no introduction because it's on the slide.
I'd like to start off by thanking a few people. First, people I'd like to thank are reviewers 2 and 5 pointing out that our first abstract was failed and completely neglected to mention in the list. It is sort of vitally important in what we do. I also would like to thank the other reviewers who actually noticed anyway that we probably were using less. I'd like to thank the part of the U.S. government that I work for funding this for the last 17 years. I'm pretty happy about that. My colleague Pete here, who's in the chair. Pete's been working with us for a while. What we have been doing for the last very while for our customers is manipulating vast amounts of record-oriented data. We receive, in fact, it's sort of a very particular kind of data. We receive record in databases, you know, sort of standard database tables. But our customers don't actually own the data that we're manipulating. So our database system is actually fairly wildly fit for retrieval and not for writing. We get asked questions sort of constantly about that are sort of just beyond the edge of what's in the data. So what we've actually endeavored to do is sort of create a sort of lingua franca to sort of get us away from the processing details of the data and actually get sort of where we can actually manipulate the data in a very tactile way. New subject matter experts, when they work with us, are always sort of amazed at how we sort of pick up the data and just sort of manipulate almost like we're holding on to it. And sort of by removing the details of processing from applications users, what we do is actually free them up to get their heads into the domain and into the problem space. This largely improves communications. There's a built-in optimization factor that happens because you tend to solve problems actually in the domain and before they get to code, you sort of have to worry about it as, you know, sort of in login or in square or sort of whatever. You tend to get sort of things there. And underneath, we've actually built a large and portable domain-independent tool set. So it doesn't really matter what data we're working on, but the project I'm working on, I've only been with it for 17 years. It's actually been going for 18. There are none of the original developers that are still there. And we've basically been answering questions that no one else can ask. Within the organization that sponsors us, we have this reputation of well, you've sort of tried and slaved at answering a problem. You've looked for data and you've sort of brought it all together and managed it however you do. You can't find the answer, go ask them. A large part of this is really because we've started on a very fundamental portable base and we sort of extended into the user domain. We'll get a lot more into how we do that. Sort of question is, you know, why do we need rapid data prototyping? I mean, trying to hear those words kind of together. Basically, what happens is, you know, this is sort of the driver in everything, I guess. Deadlines are always short. You know, here's a request. It's currently on fire. Please return it to me before it turns to ash. But sort of to get there, we sort of have to understand what the decision makers' policies are, where they're going. We actually have to sort of try to capture the data. And it's quite frequently a moving train. It's clear from many years of experience, and Pete can back me up here, that decision makers have no idea precisely what they want. They want some information in their realm. They have no idea how the data may get that, if that data even exists, or how we might arrange to have it delivered. the sort of key concept of, you know, in sort of writing this paper, we sort of broke down everything, and it sort of fell into two general areas. One is to sort of encapsulate and abstract away from the machine details of processing. This is this lingua franca This is the ability for to sort of get the application you developer out of the process of sort of groveling over the records of data by hand. We find that they tend to be terribly inefficient, write it inconsistently, so it's hard to sort of go back and debug, and tend to get it wrong on occasion. What we're trying to do actually is not really so much sort of give them just more compact ways of doing it. We want to sort of create an idiom where they think about the data fundamentally differently. And they sort of push those details away from them, and by doing so, basically free up neural cycles to get their to get this, themselves into the sort of customer headspace and sort of produce better communications there. To start off with this thing, you know, the bottom line is we want the developer to focus on what he's doing, not how it's happening. The sort of central, one of the central points here is they don't need to have any a priori knowledge about what the data structures are they're dealing with. What we do effectively is we create objects called data sets. They're like little data suitcases, and they're effectively a pile of records or something that represents a pile of records and some knowledge about how that, that pile is structured. The structured data is actually latent bound to the data set when you snatch it from whatever data source you have, whether it's a data set, a flat file, you're monkeying it in, whatever that is. And after that point, instead of actually sort of getting the data positionally, we actually refer to it by name. There's a sort of very clever set of macros that probably don't actually have an example of them, that allow you to sort of access the data by name. And one example would be we have a function called addComputedFields. It takes a data set, it takes a function that has some number of arguments, it takes the names of those arguments, and it takes the names of the return values. Simply just, you know, iterates through the records in the data set, produces a new data set, transforming it to the new data set with the new data values in it. Well, this also means that when we're actually executing this function, we can actually late find what the name is of the field. So if the customer actually in one database calls a data field foo, and in another database calls it bar, but really contains the same information, well, we can actually, the list of the field names can actually be late bound just before you call the data set. This, in the end, improves developer throughput because he's no longer saying, oh, is this the sixth thing or the tenth thing? And if the structure changes way at the beginning, he no longer has to sort of worry about how all the positional stuff happens because the positions are actually computed by the processing underneath him right before the iteration happens on the data that he sort of brought to the table at that moment. This allows you to, you know, within your domain, add sort of semantic content, categorization, if you will, to data sets by only knowing sort of a few attributes about the data set, regardless of whatever's there, whatever else is there. So this means as data sources change and evolve, we actually, within our data warehouse, we actually have several copies of the same database as represented at different points in time. I think we have data going back for about 10 years.
Nine years.
And frequently we get asked questions about, well, you know, what did this look like in 1998? You know, what did it look like in 2004? We answer these questions. And it's important to be able to have, you know, filtration devices, aggregation things, things, add computed fields, you know, all these sort of processing bits that you need to sort of manipulate the data in the way that they want to. And you only sort of have to have this minimalist knowledge about what's there, because what fields are in the table evolve over time, sort of as we, you know, as the decision makers sort of change what information they have, and the data captures, you know, the data is captured by people who are not us, sort of evolve trying to track what the decision maker wants, sort of attribute fields, things change and evolve over time. So we want to be sort of to push as much of that away from us as we can so that we're not really affected by these changes. We actually can process a pretty wide variety of data without any substantial code changes. Again, sort of, we want the user to be focusing on what, not how. As we move into the customer's world, what we really want to do is sort of capture the domain abstractions. We want to get the nouns and the verbs that the customer uses right. That's really, really important. What happens here is, I mean, it's really key because it really does increase the sort of expressiveness. It's not, you know, it's not sort of more detail. It's actually more of the right detail. It's important that you sort of talk to your customer in terms they understand. For the most part, if I tell many of them that, you know, I have a string that's 5 long, I mean, they're just looking at like delays. It's like, whatever. That doesn't mean anything to them. You know, if I tell them this is a social security number, oh, they know what that is. It's really, really important to communicate in the right language, because over time this improves the quality of your product. Recently I was actually sitting with one of our subject matter experts and reading to him the business rules right out of the code. Well, when this happens, we can see that, you know, we're doing this and this and this to the data set, and as we're going through it, you know, he goes, oh, wait, that one's wrong. I mean, he's actually reading the code that I'm writing. He can't write it. I mean, you know, sort of all the ticky little details of syntax, what little we have in this. even after a week, he sort of sees through the parentheses properly, and he actually recognizes the nouns and verbs sort of in these business rules that I've written. What happens is you work sort of shoulder to shoulder with them. You sort of pull, not only do you get pulled into their world, but they get pulled into your world. And they actually sort of understand, it gives you buy-in in the code. Yeah, they have some great confidence in the code because they actually understand how what they've told us has been translated into something that the machine understands. That's pretty vitally important. This is my hokey graphic slide. So, basically, decision makers, they give you requests, and it comes to subject matter experts. We're going to talk about them in just a second. And, you know, the requests and data and information, we may go around this loop several hundred times a day, trying to refine the data and get down to what it is. And, you know, when we talk about what a subject matter expert is, somebody who's typically very passionate about it, Pete actually helped me a lot with this slide. He deals with subject matter experts more than I do. They're very passionate about what they do. They're usually easily as smart as we are, but very, very frequently, just very blissfully aware of, you know, what is going on in the data, and they're unbelievably overtaxed. Does that sound like anybody's ever heard that before? What happens is you have to sort of educate each other, and to do this, you sort of have to. Here again, it's really important that you speak the same language. If you're sort of talking past each other, you just sort of create a lot of noise and interference on the channel, and you can't get there. And if I iterate quickly, we frequently have no qualms about pulling, you know, 50 or 100,000 records into memory. You know, that just takes a matter of a couple of seconds and manipulate those over and over and over again. I started a project that the subject matter expert, when he came to us, had been working on for 6 months. At the end of 6 months, he had sort of absolutely no idea where he was. He had a pretty good idea where he started, where he wanted to be, but he didn't really know how he got to where he was, because he would get into the details that he didn't really, was blissfully unaware of previously, and had no idea how to get out. And I have to say, it's not for the lack of being smart. A very smart man was working with me on this. The trick is we have to be able to control the data in this sort of tactile way. And effectively what happens is he's sort of the smart in the domain. I'm very smart in how to move the data around. And together, we sort of become this ball. I don't know how many people remember Caddyshack at all. One, okay, good. Yeah, this is Chevy Chase going no. You have to be the ball. You have to sort of get into the data and really understand it and understand how it applies back into the user's domain. I'm going to lay out a little bit of the tool suite. This is sort of the basic structure of the tool suite. Everything's built on a pretty solid portability layer. This has got several sort of similarities to Clock, if any of you are familiar with Clock. So several of the same things are covered there. I'll talk a little bit more about this. The only real difference is we started ours about 7 years before Clock did. We have a whole layer of domain-specific tools, and this is actually sort of semantic knowledge that we've gained about the sort of general customer world that we have over time, and has actually been canonicalized, and this is actually pretty well vetted. Pete's actually been responsible for that, and a couple of Pete's predecessors in the job he currently has. At the next level up, we have a data system that warehouses all of our data. We have a system that actually allows us to sort of acquire data from any of about 19 or 20 sources that we get. That used to actually include like 7Dragon, 9Track, Cape Prize, which unfortunately we all hunted. We have a data transformation layer, which is what I was sort of talking about earlier. It's really critical to the middle of this. We actually have an information output section. We found early on, I'll say 15 years ago, that applications developers spend a great deal of time writing very sort of detailed things about how to output information and then get it wrong anyway, almost all the time. They'll be working along and then all of a sudden they'll have to go to a slightly larger paper size and all the formatting just goes out. So what we actually do is we actually wrote a layout engine many years ago, and it's been updated a few times. And you basically give the specification one of these structured piles of data and sort of point it at an output device like an HTML stream or a file you'd like to see in a certain format, or just play it out to a ceiling window. Sort of moving through this a little bit. Portability. We currently run pretty well on top of OpenGenera, Allegro, Listworks, and MCL. We do this basically just by moving the code back and forth. It just compiles and runs. Essentially what we've done is we've taken all of the portability problems that exist about all of the code and just pushed it all into a huge pile. This is a file we call Extended Common Lisp. And it contains sort of the normal things of better string handling functions, resources, a def system, sort of the streams interface, sort of the sockets, the whole, all serving. We currently also switch back and forth between John Mallory's CLHTTP and Allegro serve. Pretty much that's just done by whatever configuration you're in. It just, based on which Lisp you're sitting on top of, it chooses one. It's just easiest that way. For the most part, this has been done for a number of years. It just runs. We occasionally put new things into it. Data acquisition and data warehousing. These are sort of the main formats that we read most of the time. There's sort of a number of other formats that are either sort of customer specific or whatever that we also absorb. But that's in general the way we get most of our data.
DBF database files? DBF?
Yeah.
You mean
relational databases? Yeah. Standard DBF. We actually just read DBF files directly. We don't even get it. Most of what happens in our data warehousing is we don't actually read the databases in their native format, we just absorb them into the warehouse, convert them into our format, and just have a nice day. It's sort of a lot less fuss. You don't have to sort of remember all the details of where how it came from. We also, on the data acquisition side, we actually archive everything we get in its original format. It's sort of this huge monster server that I don't know how much disk space is on it, something else's problem. And we just sort of keep rolling it up and compress it after we've sort of put it in the warehouse. The data warehouse has sort of three more sort of types of data. We actually classified it. We have logical databases within our realm, much like logical packages. You just refer to the database by sort of the specific database name, and the client front end knows how to go out and interrogate the server that holds the logical definitions, figures out where it is in the network, runs and fetches it, and brings it back. I don't really care where it is in the network. We actually switched from 5 servers down to 3 servers recently for our primary database servers. 4 still. Right. We went from 5 down to 4, totally different machines, because we updated all the hardware. And as we rolled across the machine to put a new server online, we copy all the things over to it. Then we would stand the database up, make the adjustment in the central file, and then just tell everybody, oh, okay, well, just, you know, reset your client, everybody sees all the new databases on the new server. It took 2 hours to install a new server after they hit the software up and install. Sitting above this, we have versioning databases. This is sort of how most user application developers actually think of the databases. They think of having a database that contains, you know, this particular table, and what happens is we have several versions of it, and just by simply changing the version name, you can actually sort of move up and down through time. The problem we have from our customer right now is we actually need to synchronize sets, because we have sets of data that go with each other that come to us from different sources, and one set comes out in June, one set comes out in August, one comes out in September, and they all go with this sort of June position. Well, you know, after about 10 years, you know, my head would be full of mush if I had to remember which went with which. So what we actually do is we have a nice little system where you can say, I just want to pick up this whole set of databases. It picks up a whole set of versioning databases, and then it actually has within the synchronized set, it tells you which particular versions go to a particular sort of meta version that's named. And those names are, all of these sort of version names are sort of named in sort of ways that are meaningful to the customer. That turns out to be very important now to them. This also is very convenient for when you're actually talking to somebody. We also serve data out over the web to people. And it turns out that they're very interested in what these version names are, and that's how they choose what position they're interested in. There's a couple of ways of doing that. Data transmission. We talked a little bit earlier about data sets being just sort of this big pile of records and sort of a description of the record structure. This really does allow us to write all of the operations in terms of what data is required to accomplish this. And not even what name is it currently called by, it, but just sort of what information is required. This sort of standard things you think of doing to data, any sort of set operation, filtering, structuring, doing some sort of summarization to it, sort of joining, rotation is sort of kind of like doing pivot tables in Excel. Merging data together is sort of different than joining. It's where you sort of zipper the two data sets together in a sort of specific way, but you're not sort of, it's not as strict as a join. There's sometimes that sort of really useful. You sort of sort everything out into groups by the specific categories, and then sort of just roll the groups together. It's helpful when you have like 5 records on one side and 4 records on the other side, and you really just want 4 records out, and you let this bottom one be sort of dangling a bit, and it's still there. You also do sorting and comparing. Comparing is really important. We actually have a really high-speed comparing operation, because frequently when we're iterating through things in rapid data prototyping, you make a change, you want to be able to verify that you made only the change that you intended. So when you've got sort of 2 piles of, you know, sort of 50 or 100,000 records, you want to sort of compare them and say, show me just the differences. And it's actually taken us a few years to get this right, but it happens in a few seconds, and it really is a nice way of highlighting the differences. Lazy data set evaluation. Okay, data sets can actually be, instead of being a big pile of records, you can actually make a virtual data set that just iterates over a structure. You give a virtual data set an iterator, and it binds the iterator, you bind the iterator over the structure you want to iterate over, And it just sort of spits out one record at a time as it iterates. This, you know, this really sort of allows you to sort of build, instead of transformational grammar, where you say, make this pile of records into this pile of records, into this pile of records, you say, oh, make this more of a data pipelining effort, so you don't ever have the big pile of records. The records sort of never pool up in the middle of the pipe. You don't have to, effectively you don't have to recons them. That's vitally important. This means that almost all of the data set operations have a deferred operator on it. So instead of having to sort of make a big pile of records, you just say, oh, well, give me the stream of records coming out of a filter, which just sort of sends out the only things that sort of survive the filter, and those go to the next operation. The first time we implemented this, we saw about 100-to-1 speed up in most of the operations going on, because it's not consing anything anymore. It's sort of a physical analogy. It's like, if you're putting out a fire, we'd rather use sort of large buckets that people have to sort of struggle and carry along to the fire, which is like a 5-inch fire hose. Most people want the fire hose. That's delivery, we talked about that a little bit earlier. The domain-specific tools layer is really important sort of to capture sort of essence of what, basically when the SME teaches you, you teach the machine. As the SME sees you do this, you're sort of encoding standard practices and domain information that he's sort of passing along to you. And eventually you get a good base of this, and we can have developers who are relatively new at this sort of get everything right, because users ask for things by particular names and they see how to manipulate them. And the routines to manipulate them have already been encoded by people who've been working for quite a long time on the project. The current implementation, we use fairly new, fairly big DAC hardware. I think actually some of the developer machines actually have 8 gigabytes in them.
Or HPs. HPs?
Yeah, HPs. So the conclusions. The really important part of this is that you really increase the flexibility and the control you have while removing the sort of details of processing. So you don't spend a lot of time thinking about the sort of minutia of how do I sort of roll through all of these records and grovel them up and, do all the bits. You sort of think of things more as transformations. You think more in the domain of the user. And in the end, this actually builds in things like optimization from the domain level. It gives you buy-in with the customer. Makes you smarter, makes him smarter. It basically allows you to get to the meaningful information that's needed. The project that I've been working on recently, we produced, after he tried for 6 months, and then I tried alone for a month to produce the answers he wanted, we actually got together for 1 week, produced the initial prototyping tool, and he answered about 50 to 100 questions off of that first tool. Then he came back out about 2 weeks later, we did another week. We've refined it a few times since then, but he's actually answered hundreds and hundreds of questions off of the information we were able to put together. And we did all of that using about 4 weeks of time on both of our part. That's it. Questions and answers? Does anybody have answers?
How much of this code could you make available? It sounds like enough material to talk about really large amounts of data around portability issues. You're really working on incredible amounts of data.
Yeah, I should tell you that currently in the warehouse there's, 10 or 12,000 tables spinning. And those have anywhere from a few hundred records to a few million records each. Probably the average is, I sort of the feeling the average is sort of in the 100,000 to 200,000 range for a given table. But there are some that are really quite enormous. To sort of answer your question a little more directly, we actually have looked at putting the portability layer out and sort of gotten permission to do that in the past, but there's sort of some things prefer to clean up before we sort of go airing it in public. things are sort of a little too terse in the wrong way. We've been looking at this. Part of the problem is we work in a realm that's not exactly public. But there is sort of effort and a push sort of, even on Northrop's part, to sort of look at getting this some more out in the world. This actually, what I'm presenting here is actually Northrop Grumman intellectual property. So, you know, the rights are sort of held by Northrop. So, not soon, but maybe not later either.
So, I take it the mode in which this is used is you have your domain expert and you have you, and you're talking to a list listener or something like something
exactly.
like that. So, I mean, have you thought about eliminating the middleman and letting the domain expert interact more directly with the data through some kind of...
Yes, but I'll go back to to tell you that the domain expert is frequently blissfully aware and would prefer to remain that way in many cases. And part of that is that he really needs to be thinking sort of at a level higher than the bits and the bobs and the data. And that what it really comes down to is we have to cut the forest down. And you sort of need somebody swinging the axe and somebody saying, we got to go more that way. You need somebody sort of who's above the fray of the data to really sort of keep their eye on the ball. What is it that we need to do in the end?
I don't quite get a sense of what sort of problems you're trying to solve. I don't mean concretely what the specific domain, but I mean sort of abstract it, what kind of problems are they?
I guess I didn't cover that. Earlier on, we talked a little bit about decision makers, and they're sort of always sort of questing for information that's not necessarily been captured in the current data stream. So frequently, we're trying to pull things out of the edge of data. We're trying to parse position names. You know, the names of positions that people are in to see if they do certain sort of job functions, things like that. Frequently. The chimpanzees
just
typed in.
What's going on, that's all.
Yes, the chimpanzees typed in. So, we have a number of sort of low-level tools like exact string match and things that we use for things like that. But also what we do is we also take data from different data sources and sort of play them against each other Okay, I'll tell you. We work for the U.S. government.
Yeah.
And that's as much as I can tell you at this point. That's great. But the point is that the data sources many times will disagree slightly, and we sort of have to sort of unify them one against the other.
So the problem of the uncertain information and kind of call it all together.
We don't do predictive we don't do predictive modeling for the same sorts of predictions that you do. When you say predictive modeling at this conference, you think of we don't do sort of classical predictive modeling. What we do is we do sort of extract data for planning purposes. The planners typically tend to be humans, not other machine processes. I think that's probably the clearest way to say that. Any other answers? Questions?